Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 7, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and we've got the usual two interviews up tonight. First, in about, 5 or 7 minutes, we'll speak with Julia Zweig, who is a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, about a piece she's got in the January-February issue of the Council's journal Foreign Affairs, Fidel's Final Victory, which is essentially counseling Washington to give up its war against Castro, acknowledge the fact that his regime is secure and popular and successful, and just grow up and try to live with Cuba. Amazing coming out of an establishment organ like the Council on Foreign Relations and Foreign Affairs, but there you have it. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Ken Sherrill, professor of political science at Hunter College, about the most recent 2006 elections. Specifically, what's up with the same-sex marriage initiatives? Did they bring any votes out for Republicans, or have they lost their power to attract? Or did they even have that power in the first place? Ken Sherrill, co-author of a paper with Patrick Egan, published by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and we'll speak with him at the bottom of the hour. And before I get to the news headlines, I should say December 7th is, of course, a day that will live in infamy. It's the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. It's also the birthday of Noam Chomsky, Willa Cather, Piero Mascagni, and me. So happy birthday to me. Thank you. And let's see. Some of the economic news. But a lot of it coming in weaker than expected. A lot of people on Wall Street thinking the economy is slowing down and perhaps quite dramatically, while the people at the Federal Reserve have been saying otherwise. They think the economy is doing okay. And why does that matter? It matters with, how quickly will the Federal Reserve ease up on the monetary brakes? When will they start cutting interest rates? Wall Street hopes the economy is weakening and that they will cut interest rates very soon, perhaps sometime early next year. The Fed has a policymaking meeting on Tuesday. They're not likely to do anything, but all eyes will be on the statement they issue for some clues as to what to expect in the coming weeks and months. But if the economy is reasonably strong, as the Fed thinks it is, then they're not likely to ease anytime soon. But if the economy is weakening significantly, as Wall Street thinks so, they will be easing. And Wall Street just loves lower interest rates. It makes everybody on this street, literally and figuratively, very, very happy when interest rates start coming down. It was funny for me to be speaking of the consciousness of Wall Street when I'm sitting on Wall Street, but I'm on it, but not of it. Some of the economic news, more specifically. This morning, the Labor Department reporting that first-time claims for unemployment insurance falling by 34,000 last week, pretty much reversing the previous week's sharp spike upwards. But the four-week moving average is creeping higher, and it does look like this indicator, which had been in pretty strong territory about a year ago, is now only in the, as I've been saying all along, good, not great territory, but it's moving a little away from that even. So it is suggesting a possible slowdown in the job market. And the job market reflects generally what's going on with the broad economy. So this is a point in the Wall Street weakening economy line and against the Federal Reserve not so weakening line. And we will find out more tomorrow morning at 8:30 when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases the monthly employment report for November. And I'm expecting more of that good, not great stuff, a solid but not spectacular job growth, and maybe some decent earnings wage growth, but nothing really spectacular, which has been pretty much what has characterized this whole business cycle expansion. Spectacular for productivity, spectacular for profits, but at best mediocre for the ordinary worker. Worse in the 80s in that respect, significantly worse in the 90s in that respect. So the most class-biased economic expansion since modern economic statistics really began in after World War II. The Mortgage Bankers Association also reporting, I believe yesterday, that their index of mortgage applications rising pretty strongly in the week ending December 1st. It's both new purchases as well as refinancing. So mortgage interest rates drifting downward as the Fed stands back. It does seem like maybe some of those animal spirits are flowing again. The housing market had slowed down and gave signs of imploding, but now it looks like it's stabilizing, and the consensus is that the worst in the housing decline is behind us, but It's a little hard to believe because if you look at the history, this despite having the greatest boom in the housing market ever in American history, the decline has been actually fairly mild so far, very weak in terms of both new building and employment and construction. Usually you get much, much sharper declines in both those measures. So it seems counterintuitive that you would see the greatest housing boom in history followed by only a weak downdraft. But I don't know, something similar kind of happened with the stock market a few years ago. Maybe we've lived in, we now enter the world of perpetual bubbles. This is the modern American economy where wages don't rise, but asset prices do. The ABC News Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index came out on Tuesday. That fell 2 points on the week. So the strong recovery that thing showed since late August into just a few weeks ago now flattening out and rolling over a little bit. So this suggests that consumers are somewhat more optimistic about the state of their personal finances, the state of the broad economy. But again, they're not bouncing off the walls with glee, that's for sure. The Institute for Supply Management, an organization of purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations, reporting their index of manufacturing fell below 50. Any number above 50 indicates an expanding manufacturing sector. Any number below 50, a contracting manufacturing sector. It's just a little below 50, 49.5, but that is certainly below what most observers were expecting, and a significant decline over from the over the last 4 or 5 months, and the employment component of that index also falling below 50. So, manufacturing employment, which has been extremely poor now since 1998 or 1999, continuing to show signs of contracting, I was wondering the other day, the absolute inability of the United States to do any kind of proper reconstruction in Iraq. We certainly managed to destroy the country, but we're unable to get the water and electricity running again, and also the failure in New Orleans around Hurricane Katrina. It just seems like there's the whole society is now incapable of doing things like that. The United States used to be characterized by this kind of roll-up-your-sleeves, can-do attitude. Now all it seems we can do is devise clever financial instruments and come up with clever consumer products, but we don't really make anything. And for a long time, I poo-pooed that it's kind of an old farts complaint. We don't make anything here anymore. But maybe there's something to that. Maybe that really has led to an atrophy of our life skills. The ISM, the Institute for Supply Management survey of non-manufacturing companies, service industries, picking up, though, last month. But also that employment number not so strong. So it seems that the service industry is doing a little better than manufacturing, but service jobs only doing slightly better than manufacturing. The job market in this expansion has been just utterly terrible. And I think I'll bring it to a close right there. Let's take a little musical break while we get Julius Zweig on the phone. That, an excerpt from Franz Schubert's trio for piano and violin and cello, number one, third movement performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. And we are now joined on the line by Julius Zweig, who is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington, D.C., and author of an article in the January-February issue of Foreign Affairs, the journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, Fidel's Final Victory. Welcome to WBAI, Julius Zweig.
Thank you, Doug.
So I was quite amazed by your article.
Why?
Well, you know.
I know, but tell me.
Well, you know, it almost made me believe those old right-wing stories about the Council on Foreign Relations being part of the international communist conspiracy or something. You have rather you're not too hard on the Cuban regime. But let's just get you to review the substance of what you have to say. You know, Fidel is looking like he's weeks, months, who knows, but certainly exiting the stage. I think the first expectation is that this is going to lead to disorder and will provide an opening for Cuban exiles in the United States to exercise a little regime change in Havana. You don't think that's going to happen. Why not?
Well, I think this is the conventional wisdom has been, as you said, that once Fidel is gone, the regime will crumble and it will be an opportunity for exiles and for the U.S. government to finally make manifest their decades-long desires and policies to change the regime, bring it down, purge the communists, and put in a multi-party democratic capitalist state. But the reason that's not going to happen is manyfold. Starters, the revolution, that Cuban regime has deep roots and doesn't govern by repression alone. And the Cuban population, although absolutely desirous of more democratic participation and economic opportunity and jobs and a better life, is also fearful of rapid change, but B, has come to expect the state to deliver on a whole variety of goods as it has. Not so well in many ways, but the expectation is that the state will continue to deliver. And finally, and probably most importantly in my view, the external environment, that is the economic sanctions, the language and rhetoric and policy of hostility and really regime change, which is sort of the essence of U.S. policy toward Cuba, helps the regime in Cuba kind of keep a consensus together. And the storyline is that outside foreign powers, whether Spain, the United States, the Soviet Union, have come and sort of encroached upon our sovereignty. And the last remaining superpower, the United States, will do that unless we maintain unity at home. And U.S. policy feeds with very real, concrete evidence that narrative.
Well, the fantasy in and around Washington is that maybe something like the transition that happened in Eastern Europe would happen in Havana. That is, people rising, throwing off the government, and embracing a Western-style political economy. Part of that, you draw the distinction between the attitudes that prevailed in Eastern Europe towards the United States and the attitudes that prevail in Cuba. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, sure. During the Cold War, the United States was seen as a beacon of freedom against Soviet tyranny, and especially during the 1980s, the United States did do a number of things to help activists, dissidents, human rights activists, labor organizers, the church, others. I'm thinking here of Poland, for example, also Czechoslovakia, to begin to sort of whittle away at Soviet tyranny. In the case of Cuba, and while that was happening during the Cold War, the United States had trade and commercial and travel and cultural ties. That is, we had embassies. Americans were free to travel as much as they wanted. There was commercial trade investment. So the whole kind of what some would call soft power ties existed, even though we were dealing with these hostile regimes behind the Soviet curtain.
So it was more seductive than bullying.
Well, absolutely. In the case of Cuba, we have a travel ban. We don't even let Cuban Americans go there. We have no nominal trade, and the Cubans are allowed to buy our agricultural goods, and that's it. So we have isolated ourselves from Cuba, and the Cuban people, who by nature and history are quite comfortable with and fond of American culture, are likewise isolated from us by virtue of U.S. policy, but also Cuban policy. So we don't have the kind of positive influence or spirit that we did with respect to the Soviet Union with respect to Cuba.
What drives Washington's policy towards Cuba? Is it just some sort of leftover anti-communism? Is it appeal to the right-wingers in Florida? What's the mix of incentives
behind
our policy?
The Washington policy toward Cuba has been remarkably bipartisan for first of all. But I would say that under the Bush administration, it has been twofold. One, very much about domestic politics, that is, the Cuban exile community and the perception that domestic politics matter more than having a serious policy, so you don't want to do anything to jeopardize Cuban votes or money, that is, Cuban exile votes or money, but also a kind of ideological spirit that really is anti-communist and that really does sort of take this notion of democracy promotion seriously, especially in the Western Hemisphere. You know, there's a kind of democratic exception. The idea of democracy promotion was something that the United States began practicing or calling its policies democracy promotion in the Western Hemisphere long before it went over to the Middle East at the beginning of the century or after September 11th. Today, what you have, though, is an interesting kind of shift of the ground. I mean, and I really mean very recently in the last couple of months and even in the last month, where the Cuban-American community is now calling upon Washington to, as the dissident community in Cuba is, calling upon Washington to allow Cuban-American travel. And probably you'll see them asking for other sorts of openings from the Cuban, from the United States toward Cuba. But under Democrats as well, this has been a policy of revenge. Fidel Castro successfully defied American power for 50 years, and by George, we're not going to let him get away with it. So we construct all kind of policies that fail, and in the end of the day, they don't have very many consequences for the United States, so it's not very appealing for politicians of either party to change them.
Well, whatever happens after his death, it looks like he personally is going to get away with it. But what about the succession? It looks like it's more than just a cult of personality that's been running Cuba.
Well, yes, it is. The fact of the matter is that we have now Fidel Castro having transferred power to Raul Castro and to half a dozen other individuals who've been sort of running the country anyway under Fidel's watch for many, many decades in some cases. And we're going to have, a charismatic regime without the charisma. What that means is that this sort of new collective leadership is going to have to start delivering on real bread and butter issues that Fidel's charisma won't compensate for now because it's not around any longer. You've got a newly strengthened Communist Party, which is attempting to make itself more relevant. You've got a very, very strong military, which has is in up to its armpits in investments. You've got foreign investment coming in at a trickle, but nevertheless coming in. And you've got a youth population that has very little attachment to the sort of historic ideals of the revolution, no memory of what it was like under Batista, and is really, really itching for change and opportunity. And I think all of those dynamics are going to make it so that this new collective leadership without Fidel is going to has already started a serious debate about how to create those new spaces.
And you also paint a picture of a society that's not really as stifled as a lot of Americans think. There's a lot of cultural and political liveliness that would surprise most Americans used to the cliché.
Well, sure. I mean, because the cliché is that it's the gulag. And I'm not saying that it's not a closed society by comparison to many in Latin America. It is still. But by comparison to what it was, not so much. Now, you still have the state totally controlling the press, but you have in the cultural sphere a wildly expressive artistic community. You have a country whose academics and scientists and professionals are totally connected to their peers internationally and who operate at world-class levels. And you have, even within the controlled media, a debate, as I was saying earlier, beginning to take place, couched in terms that wouldn't be recognizable from abroad, about property, about the economy, about growth, about how to make the country take off. And you also have, and this is different than other small island developing countries, you have significant investment in human capital. And so you have, for example, I write this in the article, 10,000 students in Cuba's Science and Technology University. You have investments in biotechnology, joint ventures in China and Malaysia and with other countries around the world for the export of pharmaceuticals. You have really the capacity to be producing not just at the sort of low scale of, you know, tourism or commodity extraction that most Latin American, especially small Caribbean islands, are doing, but high value added production as well. What's happened, though, is that they have not, this is not because of the embargo, although it's partially a deterrent. As a matter of policy, they have, the Cuban government has controlled the flow of foreign investment capital, and because they and especially Fidel Castro have been totally allergic to things like globalization and capitalism.
I'm speaking with Julia Zweig, who is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington and author of Fidel's Final Victory in the January-February issue of Foreign Affairs, Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, here we are 15 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it looked 15 years ago like Cuba was going to follow it down the drain. That didn't happen. How did they manage to adapt?
Well, yeah, they lost overnight about a $4 billion annual subsidy. Their economy in 1991 from 90 to 91 contracted by 35%. That's sort of a bigger structural adjustment package than the IMF has ever imposed on any Latin American country. And what they did was begin to make small-scale economic reforms that essentially saved them from petering out. And it's not just the economic reforms, but let me tick those off. One, they legalized private peasant markets. Two, they got rid of these huge agricultural state-run cooperatives, state farms, and turned them into cooperatives. Three, they made made it easier for private farmers to grow, invest, get capital, and make money. Four, they legalized the self-employment trades and services, about 200 different kinds, so that some Cubans, and here I'm talking about, mechanics and manicurists and hairstylists and plumbers, that sort of thing, allowed them to operate small businesses of their own. They also allowed for legalized the circulation of the dollar until 2 years ago, which meant that remittances coming in from family abroad really did get into the pockets of about half the country's population, which is 11 million, so about half of that. And they passed a joint venture law that allowed for foreign investment to come in tourism, biotechnology, mining, and a few other major industries, agriculture, for example. But the other reason that they, and here's maybe this is why you were surprised by my article again, the other reason that they survived is because the revolution had some legs still, helped out by the hostility with the United States, but also because the relationship between sovereignty, independence, and socialism had become pretty deeply ingrained, even without the Soviet Union around to sort of reinforce the ideological approach.
Well, yeah, the regime has actually succeeded in delivering high levels of literacy and health in a region where that isn't always prevalent.
Correct.
And Cubans know that.
Oh, they're very aware of it. I mean, by comparison to the Cubans, you know, they're aware of the benefits that they get on the health and education and basic social welfare front. And, you know, I think if you put the choice to them today, do you want free medical care or, you know, what your friends in the Dominican Republic would have, they might opt for the status quo.
And what about the neighborhood is changing? There's Chavez in Venezuela, but also we've got changing governments in Ecuador, Bolivia, some people.
Nicaragua,
would,
you just
Nicaragua
had Daniel Ortega elected.
Yeah, yeah. So what influence does this have on Cuba's evolution, do you think?
Well, you know, Cuba's kind of the granddaddy in a sense. I mean, Venezuela obviously is very important because Cuba gets $2 billion worth of subsidized or bartered petroleum per year now from Venezuela. And as long as oil prices remain high and Chavez was just reelected for another six-year term, they can rely on that assistance. And that's enormously helpful, to be sure. I think that the election of these kind of backlash candidates, also Correa in Ecuador, Bolivia's Evo Morales, and then, of course, Ortega, it gives Cuba a kind of renewed diplomatic cachet in the hemisphere. And you also saw that even in the broader non-aligned movement meeting there, where you had sort of large, large third world countries coming together to sort of agree on lots of heavily anti-American resolutions or resolutions about globalization or Israel-Palestine. Cuba has kind of, there's a kind of a Cuba revival going on that has to do with Cuba continuing to defy the United States, but also the election of this kind of rainbow of left governments coming into power, who are coming into power precisely because the recipes of globalization and democratization haven't delivered for the population. And the Cubans were among the first to sort of advocate this critique of what they call the neoliberal economic order that these candidates have been elected to protest. So there's some new cachet there.
Yeah. Now, there's this whole rebellion against American-style economic policy going on in the southern part of our hemisphere. How much attention is the Bush administration paying to this, or are they just so tied down in Iraq that they're really not paying much attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right way to put it, because, of course, who is the they in the Bush administration that we're talking about? I mean, the grown-ups at the senior foreign policy table are absolutely tied down with Iraq and will be not only in this administration, but whoever inherits the mantle in January of 2009. But I do think, as much as I have been very critical of the Bush administration in Latin America in the last 18 months, really in the second term when we've had Nick Burns over at the State Department and the new assistant secretary, not so new anymore, Tom Shannon, for Latin America, I think they clearly understand what's driving the election of these candidates and what the real issues are in the hemisphere, and would defend, of course, the emphasis on drug policy, counter-narcotics, and free trade. They would also acknowledge that American policy needs to better, I think they would, address sort of these deep social cleavages that are manifest. And they're not especially ideological people, the people that are managing Latin America policy by comparison to their predecessors.
Yeah, almost from a distance, it seems like there is no Latin American policy going on.
They're just not
paying much attention.
No, they're not. I mean, you know, Latin America is policy, not just Cuba policy, but overall is really driven by domestic politics. I mean, you think about trade, you think about immigration, you think about drug policy, and then, of course, Cuba. Those all have huge U.S. domestic constituencies, and often I think that's what makes it look like there is no foreign policy toward Latin America. And I think, you know, the Latin Americans complain a lot about being neglected by the United States, but frankly, I think they also recognize that they're better off when the United States is busy elsewhere and may be able to get some breathing space if the United States doesn't have such a structured policy.
I know some folks in the Latin American left are nostalgic for the 1930s when we were in depression and not paying much attention to the region, so maybe Iraq is serving the same purpose.
Perhaps.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Julia Zweig, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington, D.C., and author of Fidel's Final Victory in the January-February issue of Foreign Affairs.
Thank you for having
Journal
me, Doug.
Of Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you. And let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back in a little bit.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. This is WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial. And don't forget, we're streaming on the web, too, at WBAI.org. And if the cyber gods are in a good mood, you can even get some of the stuff on archives. So check out the WBAI website, WBAI.org. And let's take a little musical break, and we will be back with Ken Sherrill. And that was a little bit of Excuse 17's This Is Not Your Wedding Song from about 10 years ago. From the point of view of a woman at her former lover's wedding, and she wants to mess it up. And maybe if same-sex marriage were allowed, the two women would be getting married instead of having this kind of disruptive scenario. My guest now on the phone is Ken Sherrill, who is the co-author, along with Patrick Egan, of a paper called Same-Sex Marriage Initiatives and Lesbian and Gay Bisexual Voters in the 2006 election done for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which are right around the corner on the on Maiden Lane here. And you can get this report and many other things from the task force at their website, thetaskforce.org, thetaskforce.org. Welcome to WBAI, Ken.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
So before we get to your report, though, what are your impressions of the election a few weeks ago? What did it mean? Was it a victory for the center against the extreme right? Was it a more progressive turn in American politics? Was it just throw the bums out mood? What's your general impression?
All of the above.
Ah.
I think that it was more than anything else, sorry, a rejection of the current administration. And I think it was for a collection of reasons. My reading of the data indicate that there was a general sense, a general lack of confidence in the Bush administration that was galvanized by the failure to deal with Hurricane Katrina. I think that that communicated in a very dramatic fashion that the government wasn't able to do things that Americans expect of their government. And I think that that led to questioning on a wide range of issues. I think it opened the door to increasing public dissatisfaction with the war and with holding the administration accountable for the war going badly. And I think that also opened the door to a more widespread questioning of the government's priorities.
I'm amazed watching Fox these days. They seem almost otherworldly in their detachment and anger. And then, like the today's New York Post headline, "Surrender Monkeys" is their headline on the Iraq Study Group report. I mean, it seems like a reject. Just a few years ago, it seemed like far right had become the center of American politics, and now they seem very much pushed to the side. Is this something we should embrace as a serious change, or is this just a little temporary shifting of personnel?
I think that depends on several things. I think it depends on the Democrats proving themselves to be credible while in power, so that people have a reason to vote for them as opposed to simply voting to throw the rascals out. That's not going to be easy because I don't think that that the president is going to show much willingness to share in power. I think that if the government continues to fail to deliver the goods, that it's possible for the Democrats to share in the blame. In the viewers, in the voters' eyes.
All right, let's move on to your report. Same-sex marriage initiatives, there are, what, 8 of them on the ballot this year? And for the first time, one was defeated in Arizona. There was a feeling after the 2004 election that this was Karl Rove's magic bullet. It's a way to mobilize his base and boost the overall Republican vote. You were skeptical of that back in 2004, and you've got data to cast doubt on that. So tell us, why is that not the story of 2004 before we start talking about 2006?
Well, the story of 2004 was terrorism, and it was the perception that Bush was a stronger and more credible leader than John Kerry. In 2006, the war replaced terrorism as a priority for the voters. More accurately, dissatisfaction with the war. And Bush was no longer viewed as a credible, strong leader. And those two things translated into dissatisfaction with the Republican Party. The same-sex ballot initiatives in 2004 did not increase the percent of the vote that Bush got in the states where they had same-sex, where they had the initiatives, did not increase the percent of the vote that Bush got in those states as much as the percent of the vote for Bush went up in other states.
How do we know this?
Well, you know how many people voted for Bush in those states in 2000, and you know how many people voted for Bush in those states in 2004. And if you look at those states that had same-sex marriage initiatives on the ballot, the percent increase in vote for Bush was lower than the percent increase in the vote for Bush in states that did not have these referenda on the ballot.
So now, I don't think that the referenda would depress the Bush vote. So do you have any explanation for what happened, or is it just...
Yeah, but I mean, the referenda tended to be in states that Bush was going to carry anyway, and where there wasn't much of a marginal increase in the vote for Bush that you could get. What, you know, if you're going to make an argument that the referenda had an impact, it would be along these lines, and this is hypothetical, that fighting against these referenda consumed resources, campaign contributions, and volunteers that might have been used differently had the same-sex referenda not been on the ballot. There are a couple of problems with that argument. The first problem with that argument is that there's no guarantee that those campaign contributions or those volunteers would have been forthcoming had people not mobilized to oppose these referenda. One can make a strong case that what one really saw was a rising tide lifting all boats. There was a general increase in turnout nationwide because the Bush administration was so polarizing. The increase in turnout, again, was not greater in the pro-Bush counties in the states that had these referenda. So, you know, the evidence just doesn't support that argument. There's no evidence that this issue outweighed terrorism in voters' minds or the negative evaluations of John Kerry, which were significant, very substantial. And the same thing, you know, there were only, I think, three or four Senate races in states with same-sex marriage initiatives this year. In Virginia, the initiative passed, and the Democrats won. In Arizona, the initiative failed, and the Republicans won. In Tennessee, 80% of the people voted for the initiative, and it had no demonstrable effect either way. Colorado, the amendment passed and the Democrats won. Where else? Wisconsin. What states am I leaving off? I don't recall. But you know, it just was not a galvanizing issue. I mean, what happens on the issue is that Republican voters, people who are normal Republican voters, people who otherwise would be voting Republican, vote for the initiative by overwhelming margins, 70, 75, 80, even 85%. Democratic voters vote against the referenda in not quite as overwhelming a fashion. I think 75% of the Democrats voted against it in Arizona. Something in the mid 60s voted against it in Virginia. In Wisconsin, it was a majority of Democrats who voted against it, which are Republicans voting for it. And what's happened on the same-sex marriage issue, really, is that people are reversing, or I should say people, a lot of analysts are reversing cause and effect. That people have learned, really going back to the Republican National Convention of 1992, that the Republican Party is hostile to equal treatment of gay people. And the Republican Party's pushing that button has had a wider educating effect on a number of voters who are not Republicans. That is, if the Republicans are for it, then the Democrats have got to be against it. So what you see is that while Democrats are not as unanimous in their opposition as Republicans are in their support, the Republican campaigns have had the effect of educating Democratic voters on the issue.
I was speaking with Ken Cherrill, who is a professor of political science at Hunter College and co-author with Patrick Egan of Same-Sex Marriage Initiatives and Lesbian and Gay and Bisexual Voters in the 2006 Elections Report for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which you can get from the Task Force website at thetaskforce.org. By the way, the states that had those initiatives in 2006 were Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Virginia, and Wisconsin, and they passed on all of them except Arizona. Now, you in the report say that the best predictor of how the initiative is going to do is the percentage of the state's population that identifies as born again or evangelical Christian. So are they really the ones who drive this this popular appeal?
There's that party identification ideology are also strong predictors. But the percent born-again evangelical is certainly the best demographic predictor, yeah.
And so you also say that it looks like they're going to have a hard time passing in any states after these, that the ones, you know, they pick the low-hanging fruit and that's about it. Is that true?
Well, if nothing but being evangelical born again is the determining factor, then they are running out of states where this can be passed. There are some states, you know, I suspect it would pass. North Carolina, for example, if it ever gets on the ballot.
Well, that's the state that sent Jesse Helms to the Senate. So,
well, it's also the state that gave me my PhD. But they didn't know who I was. Well, actually, they did. Florida, isn't as heavily evangelical, but it has other characteristics, including highly mobilized conservative. You have to look at the nexus of party ideology and religion, religiosity. It's certainly going to be more difficult. I wouldn't make, and we don't make, the prediction that this isn't going to pass anywhere else. What we say is that it's going to be harder to pass them. One is, yes, they have gathered the low-hanging fruit. They have, and that passed these in the states where it's going to be easiest to pass them. The states where these referenda haven't happened are more liberal, are more democratic, are more secular, are less evangelical, less born again. It's going to be a tougher fight. It's going to be a harder sell. And public opinion itself is shifting. We'll see what there is to be learned from the Arizona campaign, and whether the nature of the campaign in opposition to these referenda will change in the light of the Arizona experience.
We also say that younger voters are less supportive of banning same-sex marriage than older voters.
Yeah.
The ancient classic question, is this an age effect or a cohort effect? That is, will these people change as they get older, or will the society change as these people get older? What do you think?
My guess is that society will change, and one of the reasons for thinking that is the number, the percent of openly lesbian, gay, bisexual voters varies rather strongly with age. I'm doing this from memory, but I'm quite certain that among voters under 25, 5% said they were lesbian, gay, or bisexual. This isn't in the report. Among voters over 65, only 2% said that. Now, it's a small sample. You can attribute some of this to sampling error. But if you look at polling data on lesbian, gay, bisexual voters, going back to when exit polls first asked the question, you see that there's a strong relationship with age, and it really comes down to a pre-Stonewall cohort that appears to be significantly less likely to be willing to self-disclose one's sexuality. As the percent of voters who are openly gay, lesbian, bisexual go up, the probability that individual voters will know will have a friend who's lesbian, gay, or bisexual goes up.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not just the percentage of voters, it's the percentage of neighbors and cousins who will go
well,
up over time.
Well, no.
It? No?
It's not neighbors and cousins, and Pat and I have done some work on this. It's friends. It's not relatives. It's not neighbors. It's not coworkers. It's friends. And as you go from 2% to 5%, you get more and more people who actually have friends. And that makes a difference. It's a tough issue because you have to deal with reciprocity here. I mean, is it that people who are more tolerant are people who are more likely to have gay friends, or is it that people who have gay friends are more tolerant? There's probably some of each, although my guess is that more tolerant people are more likely to have friends. In any case, the probability of becoming friendly with a gay person, it becomes much higher for younger people. And that can't diminish over time.
Yet you have some descriptions of the demographics of a lesbian, gay, bisexual voters. Very similar demographically, except that they're younger and more urban. So talk about
those
that a bit.
Those are the two biggest differences. The first thing to note and is that there is if you look at say the racial breakdown now among you find 3% of whites, 3% of blacks, 3% of Latinos. All say they're lesbian, gay, bisexual. If you here the big difference is in terms of the population density of an area. But even here, it's kind of surprising that we're finding more and more LGB voters in small cities and in rural areas. 41% of LGB voters are in cities over 50,000 people. 14% are in cities of over $500,000. If you just look at zip codes, 16% are in extremely high-density zip codes, 28% in high-density zip codes, 32% in the suburbs. But amazingly, you get 14% in low-density rural and 9% in extremely low-density rural. There's been a real growth in the suburban areas and in rural areas. The regional distribution is roughly equal. Looks like 25% plus or minus 2-3% for each region. There remain differences, as I say, in age and in education. They're not as great as they used to be. Look at those who didn't go beyond high school. It's 20%. It's 23% of all voters, 19% of LGB voters. If you look at people who have have education beyond college, 19% of all voters, 18% of LGB voters. Family income, you find a difference. About exactly 20% of LGB voters make under $30,000 a year. 18% of all voters do. At the other extreme, however, LGB people do not make as much money. If you look at people making $100,000 a year or above, it's 15% of all LGB voters making $100,000 or above, as opposed to 23%. Of all non-LGB voters. Some of that is an artifact of the age difference, but LGB voters still make less money, not as starkly less as one used to find. LGB voters are as likely to be members of labor unions as anybody else. But there are dramatic political differences. Demographic differences don't exist, but the political differences are extraordinary.
We're just about out of time, but I have to ask you this: did you notice if there is any difference in the states in which there is a minimum wage initiative? Did that improve the Democratic vote at all?
I didn't look at it. I can't tell you.
Ah, well, sorry to hear that. I'm very curious if anybody's done that work, because it'd be nice.
You can get that actually. The data on the initiative, on those initiatives, I think, are on the CNN website.
Oh, I will check into that then. All right, well, thank you for joining us.
Okay, good to talk to you.
I've been speaking with Ken Sherrill, who is a professor of political science at Hunter College and co-author of a paper published by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Same-Sex Marriage Initiatives and Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Voters in the 2006 Elections, which you can get from the Task Force website at thetaskforce.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this musical delight. from Little Man Tate, I Hate Your Band.